Hello, and welcome to this very special edition of Lipid Insights. My name is Dan Soffer. I am the guest moderator for today's Lipid Insights. If you tuned in hoping to hear Alan Brown, you will not be disappointed because today we turn the table and he is the subject of the interview. I reached out to Alan a couple of months ago for advice on operational and structural concerns in my own program, and his advice was so timely and sage that it led to today's podcast. On my agenda today, I hope to hear from him about the key elements to being a great clinician, a great lipid specialist, and how to focus your efforts to run a great lipid clinic. But I particularly like to hear the tidbits of advice he has shared from his mother, whom I quote regularly, and some biographical information as well. Many of you know Dr. Brown through his work at the National Lipid Association and at the ACC. He is the host of this podcast, of course. However, you may also know him from his performances as lead man for his revival rock band, This End Up, or as the guy who has a Henny Youngman line for every occasion. Alan is my mentor, my friend, and colleague. He is a clinical cardiologist and clinical lipid specialist who practices at the Advocate Lutheran System outside of Chicago, Illinois. And he has more than 35 years of clinical experience. He's been a teacher, mentor, and friend and colleague to so many. He has served at high levels in the ACC and is a past president of the NLA, where he continues to serve regularly as master's course lecturer. In addition to his clinical time and association effort, he has authored multiple academic papers, participated as a clinical investigator and oversight of clinical trials, serves as an administrator and director at Advocate Lutheran, and serves on advisory boards to industry and academia alike. Alan, I reviewed your CV before today's podcast so I could be up to date, and I was struck by the number of live programs you have presented. You did not mention the rock band on the CV, however, nor did you mention the recorded interview programs you do regularly that so many of us know you through. But I'll tell you that your ability to perform in front of others is noteworthy and really should be on your CV, and it's an ability that comes from the depth of who you are, and I hope we'll talk about that characteristic today. It's truly my honor to introduce my friend, Alan Brown. He's normally the MC for this program, and I'm beyond humbled to have the opportunity to sit on the other side of the desk from him to ask him about his career experiences. Today, we're going to focus on what it means to be a clinical lipid specialist and how to run a lipid clinic. I hope to hear his thoughts about where we've been, where we are now, and where we are going. And so without further ado, I welcome Alan Brown to his podcast.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Alan, My pleasure. Can you start by telling us, giving us a brief bio, where you started, where you grew up, a little about the household you grew up in, and how that led to the trajectory of where you are today?
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that you're a fan of my mother. I am too. My mom is a retired general practitioner, and she's 96 years old, but still giving sage advice.
And to be clear, I've never actually met your mother, but I've heard so much of her sage advice that I've incorporated into words to live by, that I live by, and that I've actually shared with others. But I try to give your mother credit whenever I know it's from her.
That's nice of you to say that. Yeah, so I grew up in the western suburbs of Chicago in a little town called Lombard. My mom and dad were children of immigrants from Eastern Europe, and they were born in Chicago. Both of them actually attended high school together, though I don't know that they knew each other in high school, and then reconnected in medical school. And they were both general practitioners, which were the doctors of the day back then. I think they graduated in 46 or 48 and became primary care general practitioners at the same hospital. They went into practice together, and just by default, the women in the family tended to go to my mom and the men in the family tended to go to my dad. What was unique is they bought a house that was a physician's home for about 80 years before they came to Lombard, and the house had the office built right onto the house. So I grew up with the practice as part of our household. My parents even had a lab in the basement and an x-ray machine. They used to set fractures there, and I have vivid memories of people calling in the middle of the night with an asthma attack and them saying, come on over, we'll open up the office and take care of you. Even of riding around on house calls, with particularly with my mother, who would say, come with me on the house call, keep quiet, play with the cat in the living room, and if you're quiet, I'll take you to lunch afterward. So I remember that, you know, as a young child. And I also remember how much their patients appreciated them, and on holidays, how people would ring the doorbell and bring baked goods and things like that as a thank you, which was one of the inspirations for me wanting to become a doctor. So I went to school locally in high school. I took piano lessons for about 10 years. And I was told by my mom, if I wanted to take lessons, that's fine, but you can't quit. You're going to need to stay in until you complete the lessons. But my piano teacher refused to teach anything but classical music, which is what prompted me to use lawn mowing money to buy a guitar when I was in sixth grade. And I kind of taught myself guitar and started playing with other musicians in a band as a hobby, which has been a wonderful outlet for me over all these years. I went to University of Illinois in Champaign for my bachelor's degree, and then that was followed by several years at Loyola Stritch School of Medicine in Chicago, where I did medical school residency and my cardiology fellowship. And then when I finished the fellowship, the story of how I became a lipidologist sort of comes through. I actually was very interested in being an interventional cardiologist, which I had pursued during my training and practiced up until just this past July. But the senior year of my fellowship, the American Heart Association meeting happened to be in Miami. And my chief said, if I find out that you fellows were laying on the beach the whole time and didn't go to the meeting, I'm going to strangle you. So I'm expecting each of you to present something you saw at that meeting when you come back. And interestingly enough, I was laying on the beach. I realized there's only a few days left in the meeting. So one of the other fellows and I, you know, quickly ran over to the meeting. That shows you what an academic I really am. And we went into one of the major sessions, which happened to be the Lipid Research Clinic's primary prevention trial, which was presented in 85. And so I was really struck by the fact that not only does elevated cholesterol predict risk in individuals, but here was one of the first studies that showed that actually lowering your LDL level with, at that time, a bile acid resin actually reduced risk. So when I got back, I presented that to the other fellows. I sort of felt like I knew a little something about cholesterol at that point. And then shortly thereafter, I graduated and joined my group. And the group I joined was a private practice academic group. It was former chief fellows from my institution that were practicing out in private practice. They were good clinicians. They had hired a nurse, and basically one of my senior partners that had his father drop dead when he was in his 30s in the pool. His father was a doctor also, and he was committed to prevention, but he didn't have time for it. He was a busy interventionalist, so he had hired this nurse and given her, and remember, this is 1983. He gave her, 85, I should say. He gave her a bunch of blank prescriptions and said, you know, learn about this cholesterol stuff and do whatever you need to do, but I'm going to send patients to you after I finish with their angioplasty. And, she was a very bright nurse, but because I was a self-proclaimed expert, I had been to a session. I made the comment early on that I thought some of the stuff she was doing wasn't really science. And my partners laughed and said, you know, okay, you're in charge, but make sure everything you do is science and don't be late for the cath lab. So I really came out of the gate, you know, sort of having lipids dumped on me, which was my own fault. And they did hold me to a standard that whatever I was doing should be supported by the literature. And that got me very interested. And then what happened after that, again, interestingly, is several docs were referring people to us for lipid management. And we had made a decision that all our patients who had coronary disease should just automatically be followed in the lipid clinic. We had hired two additional nurses who were great at counseling, and we developed protocols for them to manage these patients, and we didn't really charge anything, basically. We couldn't bill much for those nurses, but it was a value-added thing we did for the practice. And whenever an outside physician would call and say, what the heck are you doing? You know, I can manage this myself. I would always say, great, fantastic. You know, I'm thrilled. A lot of people don't delve into this and we think it's important, we'll be happy to send the patient back to you. But the patient already knew what their goals were. They were already on therapy. And so the first rule I learned was that it's easier to apologize than to ask for permission. I've used that rule many times. And the patients were well treated that way. And one group said, look, we'd like to do this ourselves. There was a group of three brothers who were internists and said, we'd like to learn how to do this. So I told them, we'll put a little course on for your practice. They referred to us consistently and they were good guys. And so as I started to put a course together, the Merck representative at the time, he was actually the health science liaison for Merck. He wasn't a sales rep. He overheard that we were going to do this. And he said, can I come and watch? And I said, sure. So we put on a one-day program about everything from dietary management to the drugs and the side effects. And the Merck rep HSA was so intrigued by it, he went and told his manager about it. And flash forward a couple of years, we were putting on the largest lipid tutorial in the country with about 250 docs coming every 6 months. And that was really how I met a lot of other leaders in the field. You know, I had Helmut Schrott at Iowa came and spoke, Peter Jones from Baylor, who you all know, and Michael Davidson, of course, was one of the inspirations I had early in Chicago. And all these guys came to be faculty on my program, and that's how I got to know them. And I learned from them, and we've had lifelong friendships because of it. So that's sort of the short story. Obviously, you've been through some of the things that I've done in the interim. But that's how I got started in lipids and a little bit about my childhood.
You know, I guess I hadn't thought about the timing of your career. And, you know, it's not that lipids were invented in the early 80s, but lipid therapeutics was just becoming a thing at that time. And, you know, I know from others that they would make reference to taking fire and sand to, you know, to treat their cholesterol between niacin and bile acid resins, and how complicated and difficult it was to get a regimen that anybody would possibly tolerate. Or, you know, the assumption was it's worth the pain because this is what we have to do to make people's lives better and reduce the risk for cardiovascular events. And that, yeah, in that pre-statin era. And
I remember our protocols, Dan, you're absolutely right. I mean, if the patient had normal triglycerides, we would use bile acid resins, and we'd spend a lot of time teaching the patients, you know, how to take water-soluble fiber and other things to avoid the constipation, and how to avoid taking it around their other medications so it didn't affect absorption of the other meds. And then if they had high triglycerides, we would go with niacin. And many times we ended up with both. And then lovastatin, lovastatin came out shortly thereafter, and there was a lot of discussion about cholesterols in every cell of the body and what kind of long-term diseases are we going to have if we put them on this very potent and potentially dangerous drug, lovastatin. Yeah. As you may recall, you had to do slit lamp eye exams every 6 months because they found, you know, inclusion bodies in animals. And they found hepatomas and some animal models. So we were all very nervous about using that very powerful and expensive new drug, lovastatin. But that actually was a few years into when I started in practice.
For the record, I am much younger than you, Alan. So, of course, I don't recall any of that.
We did have fibrates, and we used it with reckless abandon, you know, gemfibrozil primarily. And for people with high triglycerides, that was also an option. And there was actually a big push by the company that made gemfibrozil that, because as you know from the VA HIT study, it showed some cardiovascular benefit. That it was treating the triple, what they call the lipid triad of low HDL, high triglycerides, and high LDL.
You know, I chatted with Vitas Kachadourian a few years back, and he talked about how in his clinic, they would have barrels of bile acid resins delivered, and his patients would come with their coffee tins and fill up their coffee tins with powder. And that was how they delivered their medicine to their patients at his clinic in Beirut. So I love hearing these stories about the original lipid clinics, and I'm And, you know, you even brought up some issues when you were describing how you developed your own lipid clinic that are really relevant today, even though the context is very different. The same kinds of economics and dollars and cents issues still arise. You mentioned that your colleague said to you, yeah, please, yeah, do the lipid clinic thing. Just don't be late to cath lab. And I assume the reference is really, sure, this, we think there's relevance to this. We think it's important, but it's not gonna pay our bills at the end of the day. So do it, but please don't affect our bottom line at the end of the day. Is that pretty much what your colleagues were saying to you?
Yeah, I think it was actually even a little worse than that. I think that they said, you don't generate any revenue from this and we need you in the cath lab. And they kind of thought of this as a hobby of mine. Actually, I think my partners felt like this was a hobby of mine, and though they thought it was important, they probably didn't feel that I could do it any better than the nurse when I first came, and they knew I could cath better than the nurse, so they thought I should probably be in the cath lab, but they put up with it. And once we started doing the lipid tutorials, of course, it generated more revenue than the clinic ever did, and that wasn't the goal. But it put us on the map, and it added a lot of credibility to the clinic. And, you know, there were stages along the way, Dan, that were really interesting. Like, you know, we had a couple of really good nurses who would spend an hour with the patients talking about diet. They had a model of what a pound of fat looks like. And they really gave intensive personalized teaching to these patients. But we were taking care of somewhere around 3,000 patients. And by the time we reached that point, we had maybe 26,000 coronary patients in our practice. And so a very small percentage of them were getting outstanding care and the rest were getting nothing. And we switched over to an electronic record and actually went through a sort of a survey that was done by one of the pharmaceutical companies. And nationally, they showed that only 11% of people with coronary disease had an LDL less than 100, which at the time was the goal. Our practice had 33% less than 100, and our lipid clinic had 65% less than 100, right? So I'm embarrassed to say they wanted to be proud. They were three times the national average, but 33% was pretty bad, right? And so my answer was, send everybody to the lipid clinic. And my boss said, you must be smoking something. That's not going to happen. Your lipid clinic costs us money, and we need to hire the British National Health to get all these people managed. So come up with another option. And it just turned out that we were developing an electronic record at that time in the early 2000s. And one of my partners said, we can do a virtual lipid clinic. And I thought, no way, you know. And he said, yeah, we'll just put an alert on if the patient has coronary disease and they're not on a statin or their LDL is not at goal, we'll have that pop up when the patients are seen by the docs. And he told me this will probably work. And I said, how can that make up for the hours of intensive time? But it turned out that in a year, you know, out of 20,000 consecutive patients, we had 60% at goal and practice-wide by simply putting an alert on the chart. And that taught me an important lesson that systems turn good doctors into great doctors. And you don't have to have a Ferrari for everybody, but you got to at least have basic transportation for everybody. So do what's good for the majority of patients who really just need someone to remember, start a statin stupid, and many of them do well. Don't miss any of those people. And then leave your lipid clinic for that top of the pyramid where you have the severe hypertriglyceridemia and genetic disorders, et cetera. So
I want to stop you there and go back a little bit, because you mentioned a couple things that I know that you have talked about in the past that I want to highlight. One of which is when you first noticed what that nurse was doing and running that lipid clinic in the program that you just joined, and you had the hubris to recognize that, one, you could do it. Well, maybe you didn't. It wasn't about hubris and recognizing that you could do it better, but you recognized that what she was doing was not science. And that must have bothered you to enough of a level that you knew that if you're going to be associated with this, it should be in a very scientific manner. And is it possible, though, to give real good care without being devoted to the science? I mean, I'm sure she was still giving excellent care. Is it, what about the not being devoted to the science was problematic? Well,
I think that's great question. And it wasn't that she wasn't devoted to the science, but sometimes she didn't know where to look, right? So she would read an article, and it was hard for her to get a perspective of, was this a well-done study? And should I change what I'm doing with all these patients based on that? Or should I question the data? So that was one piece of it. And the second piece was, you know, unfortunately, mistakes I made over the years. I have a vivid memory of thinking I was a great lipid specialist and telling myself, I don't need to know this genetic stuff because you're going to treat the numbers anyway. I can't tell you over the years how many people have said that to me. Why the heck do you need to know what the disease is? You're going to just treat the numbers. And that was a lazy way for me to convince myself that I didn't need to learn this stuff. And I have a memory of a young kid in his 20s who came with a cholesterol of 300, triglycerides of 300. His HDL was about 40. And I was thinking, wow, you know, and he didn't drink. He didn't have any other bad habits. So I said to him, look, we're going to have to put you on niacin and a statin with, at the time, what we did. And this is a little hard to take. We had only, you know, three times a day niacin. You have to take an aspirin with it. And I sent him away. And he came back about 6 months later. And his numbers were perfect. And I said, I've got to admit, I'm proud of you. You're in your 20s. I never thought you would take your medicine so religiously, and your numbers are terrific. And he said, Dr. Brown, I'm not taking any meds. He said, take a look at my hands. And he showed me his orange palmar creases. And he had a book that he bought at like what would be Borders now, you know, Lipids for Idiots. He said, I've got type 3 dyslipidemia. And he showed me all of the physical findings. And I thought, and he had been drinking a lot of fruit juice and eating a lot of carbs, and he's cut his fat out of his diet and cut the sugary drinks, and his numbers went to normal, you know.
Did you make mistake more than once in your career? Or is that,
not on type 3. Boy, I knew type 3 inside and out after. But I told him, you know, I'm going to call my buddy Michael Davidson, and we might want to do some blood tests on you. And appropriately, he never returned to my clinic. So over time, I've realized that if you're going to say you're an expert, you really have to be an expert. That means you have to know the science. Nothing against that nurse who was doing her best, but as a director of a lipid clinic, number one, you need to always fall back on guidelines when you're not sure what to do. That's a safety net where you at least know you're doing something that's based in science and based in a lot of data. And it's a starting point, but it's a good fallback position if you're not sure what to do. And number two, you need to really be an expert if you say you're going to be an expert, because the patients count on you and so do the referring doctors.
You know, Alan, I'm sure I have a similar experience that you do with that. Is that one, we were all burgeoning experts at one point, and now we're in a position to mentor others. And a number of young burgeoning lipid experts around the country reach out periodically and say, hey, I'm seeing this person and they have, you know, this problem, and we bounce cases off of each other and learn from each other. So being an expert doesn't mean that you know what everybody has at all times and that you know the answer to every question, but it's worth noting that being an expert means also knowing when you don't know the answer, that there are other people to reach out to consider other options. And I think I wouldn't discourage anyone who's a burgeoning lipid specialist from hanging that shingle outside their door and saying, I'm a lipid specialist, making sure that they know that there's continued growth along the way and that you are part of a community and part of a team of colleagues who are always happy to reach out and share cases together and help you sort out complex problems.
That's very well said. I agree completely. And I think what we didn't have back then was the Lipid Association, and there were very few lipidologists. And really my fallback was to call Mike Davidson, you know, and he has a walking encyclopedia, but I was lucky to have him in town, and he was always happy to answer my calls. And I learned a lot from him. But yeah, there's no doubt I continue to learn. Every week I learned nuances, right? We thought we knew everything about familial hypercholesterolemia. In the last few years, we realized it's a lot more complicated than we think. So there's always something to learn about. But it does bring up one of my mother's quotes, which is, there's only two right answers to any question, the right one and I don't know. And there is no shame in saying, I don't know. And it's important. It's an important skill to be able to say, I don't know. And you know, go find out. And that's how you continually learn. That's the fun of medicine, obviously.
Yeah. So, so you started out with an interest. You had sort of this little grain of interest that has grown into a pearl of a career. And you've maintained your interest in lipids throughout, even as the cath lab was pulling you in one direction and all of the administrative duties pulling you in another direction. What do you think it is about lipids that has been so important for you in your career?
Wow, I have to think about that a little bit. Number one, early on, it was a niche that nobody else had. So I really felt like I was making a contribution to my organization. To this day, I'm in the ninth largest healthcare system in the United States. There's only two of us who are board certified in lipids across two states in our organization. So that's valued, and you really do feel like you're providing a service that's hard to find and, you know, that people appreciate. Secondly, because it is a small community, people always say, well, how come lipidologists are so open to talk to each other and they're friendly and they like to teach? I think partly I joke that it's because we're lonely. There aren't that many of us. And it's one of the wonderful things about it is you can actually rub elbows through the NLA with the people who you've admired your whole life and whose articles you read. And they're very happy to talk to you about patients and about science and whatnot, and very open. So it's a wonderful community. And that has, I think, continued to drive my interest. Plus, you know, I thought once we had statins, there wasn't going to be much left, right? But as you well know, literally every few months, something new is coming out to get excited about, and new treatments for patients who in the past we had no options for. So it has not been boring by any stretch of the imagination. And I think once you get on the merry-go-round, it's hard to get off. There's always something to get excited about.
So the science piqued your interest early. The growing body of literature probably showed you that there was a lot to be learned and that you could master this as you went. The opportunity to be a master in it and to teach others was probably attractive for you. I know, you know, looking at you, I mentioned your CV earlier, you love to teach, obviously, and your career has shown you to be a continuous teacher from the beginning all the way to the present. And the opportunity to have value within your system has value to you. And I think I don't want to let that last part go, because I think a lot of us who are struggling to figure out a way to make lipidology a big part of their career are finding that that's one of the biggest challenges, is how do I show my health system that I have value to the entire system, not just to each individual patient who comes through my door.
So that, as you know, is one of the points I make frequently. The first one is the saying that did not come from my mother, but I heard it from a Fortune 500 consultant, which is how you influence others. And in order to be successful in anything you do in your career, you have to be able to have influence. And that saying goes that the way you influence others has absolutely nothing to do with what they think about you. It has everything to do with how they feel about themselves when they're in your presence. So if you're going to start any endeavor within your healthcare system, you have to always be cognizant of how your efforts are going to help the whole healthcare system be better, feel better about themselves. When you say the only people who know this are us and our clinic, so you need to send everybody to us. And when financially you're struggling, you're the first thing to be gone. But if you, for example, can start a project, head up a project that allows all the doctors in your system to do a better job of prevention, number one, you're going to affect a lot more patients. And so even something as silly as make sure everyone goes home on a statin is diabetic or who has atherosclerosis, or we're going to help you come up with a way to screen people system-wide for familial hypercholesterolemia. Share your knowledge, be at the pulpit, help your healthcare system do a better job. And then you will be so valuable that you don't have to worry about what you generate. And the other piece that we talk about sometimes is, you know, there's more that you provide for your system or your practice than the E&M when you see patients. Those patients get tied to the institution. They have coronary disease. They require testing. They require diagnostic workups from carotids on down and all of that. And they all have a brother or sister who's got similar problems. So, you know, it brings patients to the institution. And the one thing we haven't talked about is how satisfying it is to do preventative work, right?
Yeah.
I have three generations sometimes in some of my families with FH. And to be able to identify someone who's young, get a calcium score, and find out that even though their LDL's 250, they don't have atherosclerosis, and start them on a journey where you're protecting them from a disease that they otherwise almost certainly would get. That's a wonderful feeling. And as a former interventionalist, many times someone would come in and I would cath them. And I remember vividly in the 80s and 90s doing a cath and finding 10, 15% blockages and telling the patient, you got very mild coronary disease, don't worry about it. And then 6 months or a year later, they came in with an acute MI.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, what is going on? We obviously don't know much about this disease. So we know a lot more now, and those people most of the time don't come back when we treat them aggressively with preventative therapy. So there's so many levels where this is great. And the final level is that, you know, whatever specialty you're doing, you're working hard. For me, I was going in at 2 a.m. doing interventions and covering the emergency room many days. And it was a long, busy, hard career. And being able to reach this stage in my life and still have something that I love to do that contributes to the organization and that doesn't require me to run in the middle of the night. I mean, it's really nice. And my final comment is I have several fellows that work in our program and they're general cardiology fellows, but three of them have gone on to run lipid clinics around the country. And what they found is that might not have been their passion. They didn't decide I'm going to be a lipidologist for their career. But because lipidologists are few and far between, having taken the time to learn about lipids and take their boards has made them much better candidates for jobs. So some are imagers, some are general cardiologists. I've got a couple of interventionalists who took their lipid boards, and they had much better job opportunities because they could bring that additional skill. And I think that would be true in any medical specialty if you had the background in lipids also.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I am curious about how you can quantify some of the downstream revenue. That's another piece that I've had colleagues ask me about around the country. And I think that is hard to do. It does take a fair ability to read a ledger and you know, connect with the right people in the office suite where you can get information. Can you speak to that at all? Like, we don't have to get into it in high detail, but.
So, you know, guideline-based approach to evaluation of these patients who are going to be at risk for coronary disease, and of course, many of them already have coronary disease and other diseases, that should be quantified. And how many people, for example, are new to your institution that came just to see you,
yeah,
as opposed to because someone referred them? And that's not as difficult as one might think, but it's very important when you start a program. And one way to deal with that is to sit down with your chief financial officer and say, you know, I'd like to look at the medical record numbers of people who came to my clinic and identify, have they been on campus before? What testing did they do in the subsequent year? And was that testing related to atherosclerosis or something that we ordered in the clinic? And you certainly don't want to be ordering stuff to trump up, you know, that, but just by good quality guideline-based care, you're going to be doing those things. And that should be appropriately attributed to your efforts. And what we found is that a lot of people came to campus who had never been there before. And so we contributed a lot of new patients, and those patients tended to stay for their gallbladders and their other things. And that showed value, but also, the appropriate testing that we did on those patients was measurable and significantly valuable. But the trick is to sit down with your CFO, say, we need to do this. The earlier you do that in your clinic development, the better. And it's not that complicated. You just have to tag the medical record numbers of people who come through your clinic.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Alan, you know, you've been a leader from early in your career, throughout your entire career. You lead in at your own workplace. You lead in associations. You lead your rock band. As far as I could tell from watching, you look like you were the leader. Do you think you have inherent leadership qualities? Do you think you had these qualities fostered by parents who recognized that you need to be a leader to succeed and that was going to suit you? Do you think it's something that you acquired along the way? I know you've talked about leadership training and how important that is, and how much of that is inherent and how much of it is can be trained. And I'm just sort of curious about your perspective on that as we wind down our conversation today.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not a leader in the band. I just do what I'm told, which is when you're in a band, that's the key. Just do what you need to do to make the whole band sound better. And every time someone tries to be a leader, that's the end of your band. So I just play. But I think, you know, this has been a metamorphosis for me. When I was young, I always felt like I wanted to achieve great things. I was president of student council in high school. But in those days, it was because I wanted to be somebody, you know. And I think that I've learned that that's not really fulfilling. It's almost an endless journey to kind of prove to yourself that you can be somebody. And the eye-opening moment for me was when this consultant who was helping us figure out the mission statement for our group told me that saying about how you influence other people. It's not what they think about you. It's how they feel about themselves and your presence. And what I realized is by doing that, instead of tooting my own horn, appreciating what those around me do, gave me a lot of influence. Again, the statement was not about making friends or being popular. It was about how do you have influence? And people wanted me around and included me in things, and that gave me opportunities. The other thing about leadership is sometimes people will tap you on the shoulder and say, how'd you like to be on this committee? Or how'd you like to do this? And most people say, you know, that's not really in my wheelhouse. I don't know that very well. I'm comfortable where I am. And they say, no, that's a mistake. If you want to be successful and you want to have leadership roles, your answer has to be yes. And then you figure, if I'm smart enough to be a doctor and I'm smart enough to do what I'm doing now, I'm smart enough to learn what I need to learn to be successful in this area that's a little out of my wheelhouse. And if you talk to really successful people, they always say yes when someone asks them for a new opportunity. And then finally, what I've learned as I got older and a little bit wiser and through my mistakes is that there is a skill to leadership, and you need to learn those skills. It's everything from emotional intelligence to understanding business, in addition to understanding medicine and broadening your horizons. But also it's understanding that you can't take your resume with you when you pass. Nobody cares what's on your resume. And that's something that, you know, you wake up one day and you just realize nobody really is reading my CV, except maybe my mother. So, but what the beauty of leadership is that with one phone call, you can change somebody's life. So you reach a position where you can do something that's very easy for you, but it's life-changing for somebody else. That's a wonderful feeling. And when you look at your career and say, what was success? There's no doubt that those are the things you think about. The people you help, the people who will never forget you. And you really don't think about how many articles you published. So I would challenge everybody to be successful professionally, but the reason is because you can pay it forward to your colleagues.
Well, I can't think of any better way to end our conversation than your last comments. I can tell you, Alan, you know, I said at the beginning, you've been a tremendous teacher. You've been a mentor to me. The things you teach me go well beyond lipid and lipoprotein physiology, but I learned from you about that. You've taught me about life. You've taught me about how to be a good doctor, how to be a good clinician, how to be a good friend, and how to be a leader. And I cherish that. And that was really why I wanted to turn the table and have you be the subject of today's interview instead of always being the interviewer. So thank you for taking the time. And I'm sure everybody who heard today shared in what I've experienced over the years, and greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Dan. I must say I learn from you every day also, and you have all the skills you need to be a giant in the field. And, you know, I'm always thrilled to see you. And I, you know, I'm very much looking forward to seeing your career continue to grow. So thank you so much for the honor of taking the time to do this, and having you do it really means a lot to me.
Great. Thanks, Alan. And thank you all for listening in to this episode of Lipid Insight. Hope you'll join us again next time when you have Alan Brown back as the MC.